Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Fred Obiero.
Hello, and welcome to the Ivy Podcast. My guest today is Keith Smith. He's the CEO and co-founder of Payability. Hey, Keith.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being on. Before we start this episode, I have one small request to our listeners. As we continue to grow the Ivy Podcast, we would appreciate if you would take just a minute of your time to leave us a review on the show, because reviews make a huge difference to podcast channels like ours. Now, time for the episode with Keith. So Keith, give us a brief introduction about yourself and your background, and maybe a little bit on what led you to co-founding your own company.
Absolutely. So the founding of Payability for me really is very personal, and it goes back a long way. In fact, it goes back to my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, all the way back to 1949. My mother's father, he was a low-paid mill worker, and he had an idea for how to do a better job of manufacturing cinder blocks. And so he struck out on his own, didn't have any idea what he was doing about how to start a business, how to manage cash flow, anything like that, but he was brave. And he set about starting this new business, and it saw a lot of success initially. It was really interesting, and he had this very innovative idea. And ultimately, though, despite initial success, he ran out of operating capital, and he ran into a tight spot, and he ended up having to close down his business. And the designs that he'd created ended up falling into the hands of a competitor. They went on to really build a small empire out of these designs and out of his ingenuity. And for him, he should have filed for bankruptcy. And instead, what he did is he decided that the right thing to do was to pay back every single one of his creditors. And so he spent the next 8 years with his family living in abject poverty and focused on trying to do the right thing and to pay these folks back. And so this is a story that is, just kind of deep-seated in our family lore and talked about all the time. And I grew up hearing this story over and over again. And so when I had an opportunity to be on the side of providing capital to entrepreneurs that are starting and making sure that they don't run out of operating capital, it really struck a chord with me. And it was almost like bringing this back full circle, being able to say, hey, being able to fulfill this mission of ensuring that entrepreneurs who have an idea and strike out to be able to do this are not going to let a temporary setback create a permanent decline in their business is something that really was mission oriented for me. And so it's been a very, very exciting journey. It's a company that we started 6.5 years ago and started it with the idea that we can provide capital to the underserved suppliers to marketplaces online. And there are about 4.5 million e-commerce suppliers that sell through marketplaces and platforms. And those are our customers. And I get to wake up every day with that mission in mind of making sure that those folks don't run out of operating capital and let a temporary setback create a permanent problem in their business.
That's great. Thanks for sharing that personal story that basically translates to how you started your company. One quick question. You said your grandfather basically ended up having his designs taken over by his direct competitor. Was that through an acquisition, or is it just because they stole it because he was going through financial challenges?
Yeah, it was really unfortunately the latter. His understanding of intellectual property rights was quite limited. Didn't understand how to protect himself. Wouldn't have understood how to enforce those rights if he had actually trademarked and copyrighted them. And in fact, my uncles tell this story of how when my grandfather was going through hard times, the executives from this other company came by and they wanted to see what he was doing. And my grandfather just gleefully told them what he was doing. And so he didn't have a sense for business. It was really what it came down to. And he was a very trusting soul. And frankly, though, there are a lot of folks like that are starting businesses today, and it's their first business. They sometimes don't necessarily have the experience needed. And so part of this mission that I view is to look beyond kind of the typical signals that finance companies look for to be able to figure out, is this company going to be a good bet and should we finance this company or not? And the most obvious version of that is we've decided early on that we are not going to pull credit on the founders and the executives of the companies that we provide capital for. And that is the primary lens still that even most fintechs look at, is they say, what is the FICO score of the founder? And our view was that that's not a great signal as to whether or not they are going to be a good bet. And so we look for other signals, and it's been very successful for us. And by our count, our version is a much more accurate way, at least for the types of sellers and types of small businesses that we provide capital for, than just looking at the FICO of the founder.
So we have listeners in all sections of the globe, from, you know, Europe, the States, Australia, even Africa. Do you guys provide capital to basically all e-commerce folks worldwide, or is it just North America for now?
So yeah, not yet is the answer to the worldwide story. We do some. We will work with some sellers who are located outside of the US, as long as they are selling their products inside the US on marketplaces that are located in the US, and if the sales are denominated in US dollars. And so that's a pretty significant limitation that we have today. But we are going to be expanding beyond that in the not too distant future. And so, of course, that takes capital, it takes momentum, and we are getting to the place where we can start to see on the horizon the ability for us to be able to start to expand and to really serve these communities outside of the US as well. But today, anyway, it is pre-US centric, at least in terms of where the actual our customers are selling their products and the denominations, specifically USD denominated kinds of transactions.
Wonderful. And that's a perfect segue to my next question. And I want to talk about innovation. What strategies do you employ that regularly help you come up with brilliant ways to solve certain problems for your company's products?
Well, I would love to say that I could come up with brilliant strategies all the time for our company. The reality is that it takes a team, and it creates, and I view my job at this stage in our company's life, we're almost 100 employees. We've been in business for 6 years. We have good momentum. We provided billions of dollars in financing for our target customers. And so my job is less about innovation and more about creating an environment where innovation can happen and can thrive. And that's, as I've come to find out, it's much harder to do that than it sounds. And it's much harder to do than probably even innovating, individually on your own, but it's much more impactful, much more rewarding. And I think there's this core theme of innovation. And I think this is one that I've been thinking about for a long time, but it's something that at first it just didn't make a lot of sense. But as I started to really dig on it more, it started to make more sense. And that is that I think that the key to innovation is empathy. And the vast majority of companies and people who are innovating and creating interesting solutions, they are usually not solutions that would be only for the people who are creating them. They're usually for a much wider audience. And if you're going to create a solution or an innovation for a group of folks who you may understand a little bit, but you aren't necessarily a part of that group, you're going to need to empathize with them. You're going to need to understand, what is it that their day is like? What is it like to walk a mile in their shoes? And that's true whether you're doing innovations internally, because you're trying to figure out how to be able to create a better process. And maybe somebody from sales is working with somebody in marketing, or somebody in product is working with somebody in dev. Or it carries over to if we're trying to create a cool innovation for our sellers who are selling on Walmart or on Amazon or on eBay. And so it starts with this place of empathy. And so for me, it's about trying to create an environment within our company where empathy can flow. We can understand the empathy, we can communicate the empathy back and forth to each other, and where early innovations can actually start to see the light of day. And that's a challenge, and it's a fun challenge. And it's one of the things that I certainly focus on the most at this point in time.
That's unique, because empathy is a word that's been coming up frequently when I speak with different executives, especially given the year that we had last year, even till now. You know, everyone's still talking about post-COVID, even though we're still in the throes of COVID. And empathy, especially at the leadership level, is something that has to be one of the core tenets of any business that wants to be successful. So it's actually wonderful to hear that you guys are doing that, especially from your capacity as a CEO and the leader of the company.
Yeah, and I think, and it is challenging to do, I think, in the best of times. And you're right, it has become even more necessary in the environment that we've all been living in for the last 18 months. And so it's even harder, I think, to really create that environment of empathy. And at the same time, it's difficult to create, I think, a culture almost of any kind in a distributed environment where people's interaction with each other and employees' interactions with each other is all just through the lens of, you know, of a Zoom window on their right. screen. And so it becomes this very two-dimensional kind of relationship. And that's a challenge. And it's one that we're constantly trying to think about. How do we overcome it? How do we leverage the positive aspects of it? And how do we try to mitigate the negative impacts of that kind of a distributed environment?
What are some of the barriers that fintech companies face when it comes to their collaboration with traditional financial institutions and banks?
Yeah, this is a really interesting topic because you have, you know, and it comes back to empathy, quite frankly, again, because you have folks at large banks, large financial institutions that have just done amazing things and really in many ways have created, you know, the capitalist backbone for the most consequential capitalist economy in the world, meaning America. And so you have that on one side, and they have a very different set of problems and challenges and issues that they wake up every single day facing than the folks that are sitting in a startup that are trying to innovate, that are trying to be disruptive, that are really, if anything, trying to challenge the incumbency rather than to protect the incumbency. And so you start from this place of just two very different perspectives in terms of, you know, probably of what their priorities are, what their bonuses are going to be paid off of, et cetera. And so again, it comes back to this, trying to make sure that as a startup, we can understand what those large financial institutions are trying to accomplish and not just write them off as the incumbency, but really try to recognize the genius that is going on there and work closely with them. And then hopefully pick partners that can share in that same empathy and understand that as a startup, you may not have unlimited resources. You may have had to make decisions that are not necessarily the best long-term decisions because you know, you have to figure out how to be able to kind of build this company. And oftentimes there are kind of near-term kinds of decisions that you have to make and with limited resources. And so being able to try to find common ground again around that empathy is really critical in order to be able to develop those kinds of relationships.
You mentioned that Payability has been in existence for about 6.5 years. Could you share recommendations on how to overcome some of the risks and barriers that you personally experience as a fintech startup?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We have not taken the path of raising a ton of capital. And so like the typical Silicon Valley startup that goes out and raises a large Series A and then B and you're still not profitable, we took a very different approach. And we said, okay, we're gonna raise a very small amount of money. And we are going to try to figure out how to be able to use that small amount of money to develop a really interesting platform and to be able to figure out how to be able to get really good unit economics, meaning that if we can figure out how to deliver our service to even some of the smallest customers in our particular segment, then our view is that we can go up market from there. And so that's been sort of our strategy. But what it's led us to is a challenge of being in the business of selling money when you don't have any money. And that can sometimes be challenging. But what it's created is it's created this really interesting dynamic where we've brought together a group of people who have figured out how to be able to do a lot with a little. And we have a saying around here, it's hard to paint a Picasso with a roller brush. And yet, figuring out how to be able to do something really beautiful, but to do it with limited resources, it really brings us back to this old saying of necessity is the mother of invention, and it creates a bunch of really creative folks. And I think it's beneficial for us long-term. So those are some of the challenges, kind of how we've addressed them. I don't know that that's necessarily a typical kind of challenge because a lot of companies do go out and raise a lot of money and they have very different challenges that come with that. But that's certainly been part of our path and part of our journey.
That's wonderful. And for how you guys raised money, was it mainly just bootstrapping and angel investors since you guys didn't go the VC route?
Yes, essentially. It was actually our co-founder provided us with some initial capital. And then we have, back to your prior question about large institutions, we then, leverage the product that we built early on and the innovative risk model that we had created in order to be able to establish relationships with large institutional financial institutions. And that allowed us to be able to then tap into the dollars we needed to be able to fund our customers. So it still left us in a place where we had to be very bootstrapped and we didn't have a lot of capital to build the business, but we at least had plenty of capital to provide to our customers. And so that was really critical because so much of financial institutions' promise to their customer is it's all founded on this sense of trust. And they need to be able to trust that we're going to be able to make good on the financial commitments that we make to them. And so we've been blessed enough to be able to establish those relationships with large bank and non-bank entities to be able to allow us to get access to capital, primarily just because we have a really innovative and very accurate risk model. And that has allowed us to be able to have plenty of capital to be able to fund our customers, still leaving us in a place where we have to think like a bootstrap company to build our own business. But we have plenty of capital to be able to provide to those e-commerce sellers who need capital as they're growing.
There's been a lot of changes that we're witnessing in the financials and tech space over the last few years. And I'm curious to know from your perspective, what are some of the most recent trends that you believe will dominate the fintech industry over the coming few years? And also a follow-up to that is, does cryptocurrency have a role to play in that?
So, I think the very short answer to the second question is yes. What it is, I'm not quite sure. But I think the answer, I think, to the first question is, in terms of what are the trends, I think two trends that are probably not talked about enough that I think are going to be very significant trends are settlement and ownership. And what I mean by that is at any given point in time in the world's economy, there are literally trillions of dollars that are changing hands in the form of trade. And so it might be me as a supplier who is providing inventory to another company. And so I ship the inventory and then there's money that's changing hands. And that stuff does not happen concurrent with each other. It does not happen simultaneously. And so there's always a settlement process that is going on. And being able to shorten the time around that settlement is going to be something that will help the world's economy move significantly faster. And what's key in order to be able to do that settlement faster is we have to understand ownership. And so if you think about, in our world, our primary risk lens that we look through, instead of looking at the credit score of the founder of the company, is to look at what is the history of the relationship between this seller and the marketplace or platform that they are selling on, and what is the nature of the underlying receivables and assets that they have, and what state are they in at any point in time. And so we need to understand, what is the ownership of this product at this point in time? What is it tomorrow after the customer's bought it? Where is it at any point in time? And who owes money for that? And where is that money sitting at any point in time? And it's amazing how loose that understanding of settlement and ownership is in our world economy. And I think the blockchain in particular, maybe not so much cryptocurrency, but specifically blockchain, will have a huge impact both on settlement and on ownership of the underlying assets. And understanding the ownership of the underlying assets will allow that settlement to be able to happen significantly faster.
So earlier you talked about empathy and how that's playing a big role in leadership today. And the example you gave is how, right now it's kind of hard. It's a challenge because you're looking at people through Zoom. And from a communication perspective, what strategies do you enact to make sure that your personality and management style come through remotely, particularly when it comes to nonverbal communications with your direct reports?
What a great question. And it is such a challenge. And it's funny because I didn't realize how bad I was at this for the first probably 9 months.
Don't be too hard on yourself.
That's my job. I'm supposed to be hard on myself. But it was funny because I thought, hey, I'm saying the same words. I'm saying them in the same way. I'm probably saying them more often to the team when we went into remote work and we were working from home. But we also grew significantly. And so we added a bunch of new folks. And so we had a whole bunch of new employees in the company. And the only way they knew me was through this little lens on the screen. Yeah. And so they didn't know if they could trust me. They didn't have a sense for me or anything like that. And I just kind of made this assumption that I still had the same level of trust and camaraderie with my team that I had when we were all together in the same place. And some of the signals started to come out that wasn't the case. And so we had to take some action. And I'm not sure we have all the answers for it, but we're at least aware that it's a challenge. And I think it's especially a challenge for newer entry-level kinds of employees who are just entering the workforce, because it's so critical to get that mentorship and that hands-on and just absorbing, what is it like to be in the office? How do we communicate with each other? You know, what is expected of me in terms of that communication with each other? And you just pick up so much of that by seeing it. And when you lose all of that and you lose all the kind of the peripheral data that we otherwise get, and you just get this little singular blinders on kind of, you know, singular window, you lose a lot of that. So I was very anxious to get us back in the office. That was met with some resistance by some folks, and some were very excited about it because they had some of the same sentiments that I did. But it's interesting. One of the things that we've done, and I think this is, I wouldn't call this a strategy, but I think it's a really interesting tactic, is that with our leadership team now, one of the things that we do is we set aside about a third of our every other week meeting that we have with our company-wide leadership team to do what we call story time. And story time is simply, we pick one person and pick them in advance so they have plenty of time to worry and fret about this project. But they tell the rest of the other leaders in the company stories about themselves growing up or even as an adult that shaped them and that turned them into who they are. And it's this really interesting aspect where in some ways it can sometimes feel a little bit superfluous, a little bit like, oh, should we be spending our company time doing this? But the reality is it just gives us a sense for each other that we don't get, you know, in any other way other than hearing stories about your past, things that shaped you, things that made you into who you are. And it's really having a very positive impact. So I've been really enjoying that. And it's not necessarily a full-on strategy, but it is a really interesting tactic. And I think it's one that we'll continue to see bear fruit for us.
I think that's actually very important for team building. I've heard of different companies doing different things similar to that, but to a different degree. Some people bring in a yoga instructor and have everybody else on there. Now, let me ask you this. Are you guys all fully back in the office or are some people just doing remote full time?
Yeah, we are still very much hybrid. So we have two primary locations. We are located in New York City as well as in Poland. And in Poland, we actually have two offices in Poland. And so just in terms of vaccination status, et cetera, Poland is a little bit behind the US, or at least had been. I think they're probably catching up at this point in time. But that's meant that we've had a little bit different timeframes for when we open up the offices. And so our approach has been, when it's safe in a particular location to be able to go back, then we want folks to go back in the office, but it's not required. But if you are going to go back in the office, the requirement is to be vaccinated. And so that's how we've managed it so far. We're probably going to make a change to that sometime around the beginning of the year and try to get more folks to be back in the office. But at this point in time, in our New York office, on any given day, it's about 60% of the folks that are back in the office. And it's really nice. I got to say, it has fed my soul in ways that I didn't expect to happen. And just being around the people who are, you know, on the same journey with you, fighting for the same mission every single day, it really is rewarding at a very human level, and it's been really enjoyable.
Builds that synergy. That's wonderful to hear. Now, let's talk about analytics. Businesses are increasingly relying on data to create value and make well-informed strategic decisions. To the extent that you can share, what are some of the data attributes that your teams analyze to ensure that they reduce their financial risk exposure while providing capital to e-commerce entrepreneurs?
Yeah, this is a great line of questioning because it really goes to the heart of what we're trying to innovate around. And that is to use data to be able to make significantly better decisions than we could without that data. And so if you just take the simple example of a seller, a small business who's decided to sell their e-commerce products through, say, Amazon. And so, you know, as I mentioned, we could look at the FICO of the founder, but that's only going to give us a very limited kind of snapshot sense of how good this person is at managing money. What we really care about is, what is the nature of their relationship with Amazon and selling through Amazon according to all the rules that Amazon has? And so the good news is Amazon is the source of truth of all of that data. And so we don't have to rely on you know, the customer reporting their own data to us or telling us information about themselves. They can simply grant us access to the APIs that are provided by these platforms. And then our robots can download all that data, analyze all that data, and make a significantly better risk-based decision about whether or not we should provide capital to this particular seller. And that's really the lens that we look at this through. And so when we think about analytics and machine learning and all of this, really all of that is the primary goal in all of that is better decision-making. And some of that is, allowing people to make better decisions. Mm-hmm. But ideally, it's a matter of letting the robots make those decisions, because the robots can generally do it better than the humans can, and hopefully without some of the biases that we as humans develop over time. And we can create a more equitable kind of financing risk model. And certainly that's our view of what we have created and what we're going to continue to innovate on. But it's really all about that decision-making and making sure that the data points going into that decision-making engine are coming from a place that can be trusted, and that you know the data is accurate, or at least the preponderance of that data is accurate. And that will allow not only humans, but more importantly, robots to make better decisions.
That's actually very insightful. I have one question now. For your AI robots, are those homegrown, or do you just use software as a service from a third-party supplier?
So they're homegrown, but they are built on tools or with tools that, it makes it clear every day we are standing on the shoulders of giants. And so, this is not something we could have built from the ground up. There are really amazing tools that are out there and available at this point in time that we can then take and leverage, but they aren't necessarily out of the box kinds of solutions. So you have to have brilliant engineers who know how to be able to wield those tools. And so that's certainly our approach. And it's possible that if we were starting this over today, we might take a slightly different approach, but certainly when we started 6.5 years ago, it was clear that we needed to build this stuff ourselves. And the tools over time have changed several times. We've upgraded and started using different sets of tools as different tools have become available. But rolling our own has been really critical, and primarily just because we were trying to innovate around the risk model, and because others hadn't taken that same approach, there wasn't really an off-the-shelf kind of solution that we could grab. And so we really did have to roll our own in that particular sense.
Now to my final question, I've gotten a sense of where you started and a little bit of your motivation just based on the personal story that you opened up this podcast episode with. But what has helped you to get where you are today? And what of advice would you give to someone that wants to pursue a career that's identical to yours?
So my advice is a little bit counterintuitive, or maybe a lot counterintuitive, but my advice to somebody who says, hey, I want to start a business, what advice would you give me? I almost always say, don't do it. And there's a reason why I say don't do it. It's not because I'm trying to actually discourage them. The reason why I say don't do it is because there are frankly a lot of better ways and more consistent, more reliable ways to be able to create personal wealth or family wealth. There are more reliable ways to have an impact on the world, because the reality is most startups do actually fail. Yes, exactly. And so it takes a certain amount of grit and insanity combined together, I think, to be able to, and luck, quite frankly, to be able to be successful at starting a company. And so when I give the advice, don't do it, the reason for that is because if my little advice from somebody who probably doesn't matter to that person a whole lot is going to deter them from starting a business, then they probably are going to be much happier doing something else anyway, because there's going to be a lot bigger obstacles. But if they hear my advice and they go, forget that guy, I'm doing it anyway, because this is a need within me that I need to go and create something that didn't exist before, then that's the kind of person who should break down those walls and probably should be going out starting their own business.
I can't agree with that more, because if people are coming to you and asking you that and you tell them, don't do it, it's like you said, you need to be a little bit crazy and understand that there's going to be a lot of headwind and challenges that you got to face. And if they take no and just don't do it, then clearly setting a business was not in the plans for them. But if they still push on, based on the feedback that you provided, I think those are the people that will make better business leaders and startup founders in the future. So it's fun that you say that, because that's the same thing that I tell people when they seek my advice, now that I've started a lot of companies. But it's worth noting that, if you decide to start a company, there's a lot of challenges that come with that. I work for a startup now and I've seen it firsthand. It's very challenging, but it takes a lot of energy and effort and a good team surrounding you to be able to execute.
That's so right. And even the smartest entrepreneur with the best financial backing in the best market with the best product, she is still going to need luck in order to be able to be successful. That's the reality of it. And so you have to be okay with, you can reduce your risk a lot. You can you can prepare a lot. You can make sure that all those pieces are in place in order to give you a better chance of success, but it still takes luck. And anybody who's successful, who doesn't owe a portion of their success to luck, is probably fooling themselves first and then everybody else. And so there are more predictable ways to be able to have an impact on the world and or to create wealth. I would argue also, though, that there are probably no more fun ways and no more interesting ways than starting your own company. So I don't mean to disparage that journey at all. I think it is a delightful journey and I enjoy it almost every single day. But it is a lot of fun. And yet at the same time, there are more consistent, more reliable ways to be able to have an impact.
Yeah, thanks for that. You gave us both sides of the coin, and I think it's very insightful. And with that, thank you all for coming on and sharing your insights with us. I look forward to catching up with you in the near future, Keith.
Thank you, Fred. I really appreciate it and really enjoyed this.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Ivy Podcast. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast listening platform. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.